If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Our next guest is Adam Koons. He is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire, where he teaches political philosophy and constitutional law. He's got a PhD from the University of California and a law degree from George Washington University. He writes and teaches on tolerance, the limits of freedom of religion, theories of justice, and he's the author of To Hell with Heaven, a fascinating title. Welcome to the show, Dr. Koons. How are you?
Good. How are you, Karen?
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, I want to talk just a bit about your background, because your background makes what you've chosen to do as your profession very interesting. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about it?
Sure. I was raised in Southeast Idaho. I'm on both sides of my family. I was at least a fourth-generation Mormon. That's the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I grew up calling them Mormons, and I still call them Mormons. So that background is one that brought me into law school. I was on the side of those who defended the idea of freedom of religion. I saw myself as being a constitutional lawyer on the religious freedom side. And then as I began to explore my own faith and the faith of other people and experience the diverse world, now, well into my adulthood, I've abandoned Mormonism and have decided that it's not for me nor my family. So I have come from this topic from both perspectives.
Very, very interesting. Thinking you were going to be on one side and ending up on the other. You know, I read constantly these statistics about how people are becoming less religious, that churches have fewer people in attendance. Younger people are saying they don't believe or they don't practice religion. But yet we have extremism. What can you define what a cult is under the academic, I guess, definition that you go under as you teach your classes?
Sure, I would be happy to. Yeah, we use the word cult in our kind of colloquial, conversational way all the time, and that usually what people mean when they say the word cult, they mean, I don't like that religion, or that religion freaks me out. from the scholarly perspective, though, the word cult has a pretty unique definition. You really are looking for four things, and we can go into them if you want to, but I'll give you the four factors right now. So you need a charismatic leader at the front. That person could be dead or alive. But someone who has basically captured the community's attention and convinced them that they are something special, that they speak on behalf of God. You need some kind of transcendental ideology that the charismatic leader is giving. So that's factor number two. And then what kind of tips the balance between just religion and cult are basically two things: the systems of control and the systems of influence. The systems of control are what you and I are familiar as lawyers. The kind of written rules, the explicit instructions that are given to members, you must do this, you must obey these things. And then the systems of influence are basically the kind of penumbras, the things on the outside, the pressure from the group to keep you in, the threat of being ostracized, threat of harassment, being disfellowshipped, or even being abandoned by your family. If you have all four of those things, it's a little bit like the word democracy. We know what the word democracy means when we look it up in the dictionary. But we can't really tell from a country whether it's an on and off switch. We can't say that's definitively a democracy. But we can look for red flags, and we can look for hints that say that looks more likely than not that it's a democracy. The same is true with a cult. If we have those four factors, we can kind of say, all right, that's more likely than not that we're dealing with a cult. Now, we still want to be open to the possibility that we don't want to ostracize. We don't want to use the word in the way where we say, oh, that's just weird and we don't like you. The scholarly definition is more trying to approximate those four factors in the best way we can.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're talking to Dr. Adam Koons, and we're going to talk a little bit about when do our laws enable people to step in and stop the brainwashing or extricate members who might be harming themselves or others as a result of their cult activity. Dr. Koons, let's get right to this issue that is just fascinating to me, which is at What part, doesn't all religion have some form of indoctrination in some way? And when does it cross the line that a cult is doing something that we are going to maybe make it, draw a conclusion that this is unhealthy? Is there a way to actually draw that line?
That's a great question. So I often joke that the difference between a cult and religion is just time. And that all you have to really do is just wait around a few thousand years and your cult will become an acceptable religion. But really what I'm meaning with that facetious answer is basically that time purges that part of cults that creates those systems of influence. So take Christianity, for instance. It began as a cult. It was recognized as a cult by Romans and Jewish scholars. But over time, it's tended to purge those elements of it that tend to have those systems of influence where people are ostracized or harassed or cut off from their families. Now, we can still find plenty of examples of Christian sects that do that. So there we would say, all right, we see some cult red flags happening. So I think with regard to the actual effect on members, the kind of brainwashing or indoctrination that you might see, religions do indoctrinate. They do have dogmas. They do have core beliefs, and there's nothing wrong with having those beliefs. But the question is how much autonomy are you giving the person? So are you allowing them to dissent? Can they publicly criticize the faith? Are they allowed to question the faith? Are they allowed to speak about issues that are tangential to the faith but which are political or cultural topics? And if they can do that without fear of being punished or without fear of losing their family members or their friends, then I think cult red flags start to diminish. But if there is a kind of policing system in place that reduces that person's autonomy, then we start to cross the line into the scholarly definition of cult.
And now I'm going to take that conversation one step further. Is it against any law that you're aware of, whether it's a federal law or a state law in any of our states, does any of that cross over the law? I mean, clearly, if there's financial, misconduct, clearly, if there's harm, physical harm to somebody or imprisoning somebody, those are all things that can be prosecuted. But if you're just talking about indoctrinating and brainwashing people, does that violate a law?
It does not. So our First Amendment, the Free Exercise Clause, is pretty expansive. Historically, there was a pretty bright red line with the Free Exercise Clause. It actually involved a case with regard to Mormons. So the practice of polygamy, it's called the Reynolds case from the 19th century, where the court did try to say, look, we can punish acts. We can punish bad acts. You're welcome to believe in polygamy. But when you're abusing women and you're especially young minor women and bringing them in as extra wives, we can punish that kind of behavior. The court has since, though, especially in the last 30 years, walked that back pretty significantly. Your free exercise rights are very expansive in the United States, and there is not a very clean definition from the Supreme Court or any court as to what counts as a religion. Religion is very much just a philosophical set of beliefs that give you some higher purpose. That's basically the legal test. So in terms of your private beliefs, you can believe anything. If you want to believe that there is a flying spaghetti monster out there in the space somewhere, you're welcome to it. Now, you are correct, though, Karen. When we do start to actually physically harm people, when we do start to ruin people's lives, that's where we can begin to prosecute. But the brainwashing period, that transition period from just having belief to actually going and affecting a person's life, that's the harder one to crack. And there are such things as psychological manipulation. You can absolutely have emotional distress. You can certainly find all of those things can be stacked on top of them, one another, to meet the clear and convincing test to say, look, over time I was manipulated. Options were taken away from me. And that then ultimately led to the physical, financial, emotional harm, whatever it may be.
And, you know, there's so many different aspects of brainwashing. I mean, I'm a family law lawyer, and I see when it comes to domestic violence, you often see a brainwashing-ish kind of dynamic where, somebody brings someone else into the relationship, everything's great, there's love bombing, there's all kinds of good stuff, and then all of a sudden, the financial piece gets taken away, isolation from family and friends, and then abuse verbal, and then maybe abuse physical. And so, again, none of those things really, you know, with consenting adults are not prosecuting. You know, you can't prosecute those things. Only when it crosses that line to physical violence are there laws that protect. Do you see that there's an analogy between that type of thing? and what we're talking
Absolutely.
About?
I think at the end of the day, what we're really talking about here is just any forms of authoritarianism in a person's life. So you could imagine this from a political lens, from a family lens, from a religious lens. It's any time that we're ceding over our decision making to somebody else. And you mentioned the fact, the love bombing. That's often how it starts. A good indication that you are in an authoritarian group, and in this case, a religious cult, is someone telling you, don't talk to your family members, don't talk to the people who are your biological support system. The new family, the organization, we know what's best for you in a way that that your normal friends and family don't. And that can be physical isolation, where you're literally on a commune somewhere, or it can just be emotional isolation, where you're told, if you call your family, we will be listening. If you are meeting with family members or trying to reach out to friends, we will notice that. And that's a way of essentially making the person, just like in the family law situation, feel like they can't get out and that they must be beholden to this person. And eventually that produces psychological effects like Stockholm syndrome, and you become very, very attached to your abuser.
And so let's just give an example. I have an adult son, let's say, and he is 35 years old. He's well-educated. He's otherwise very mentally and emotionally healthy. He somehow gets into a situation where he's in a cult and he's living in squalor. And you see that son and you see that person you love and you want to get him out of there. What legally can a parent or friend or spouse or anyone do to extricate somebody from a cult like this?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think there are a ton of laws that are actually going to bail that person out. When we're dealing with an adult, especially someone who's chosen the faith as an adult and they've made this determination for themselves, legally speaking, there's not a whole lot that one can do because they are ultimately, in the eyes of the law, they've made a rational decision. They've opted to be a member of this organization, and there's really you as a parent, no matter how much you might love this person, there are not a lot of legal tools on table until there are actual signs of harm, right? So until you actually see that there's the need for a welfare check or there's a need for somebody intervening in some way through, like, social work, there's really not a whole lot you can do. What you can do privately, though, when the law does not give you an answer, you can absolutely continue to love that person. And I think the main message that we at the Lawlich Center, for instance, support is the idea of always having our doors open. No matter how far that 35-year-old goes, no matter how many places that person might go with their faith, you must always be the open door, because there will come a point where that 35-year-old child will say, you know, I miss mom, or I miss that feeling of acceptance that I had as a child. And that will reawaken in them this desire to say, you know, I really need to reconnect. You never know when that's going to happen. And so those family members who might have people who are in those kinds of organizations, I would say never, ever, ever give up.
And it's the same thing in domestic violence. You know, you can't tell somebody what to do in a situation like that, but the door needs to be open so that, you know, if they do want to leave and they need financial help or otherwise, you're there and they know that. This is not a legal question, but, you know, when you see people get out of cults, people who have been really indoctrinated into a cult, when they finally do leave, what is the precipitating factor in the majority of the cases that you see?
That's a great question. For me, as someone who left the Mormon Church, I can give you a really good example on a personal level. I was deep into Mormon doctrine. There is no amount of rationality that you could have given me, especially when I was a Mormon missionary, to try to convince me that Mormonism was false. The kind of logical or philosophical arguments almost are never the things that are going to do it. And it's because those are signs to the person who's in the cult that they are on the right path. If they face persecution and hostility from a family member, it's an indication to them, this is just proving the transcendental ideology is correct. It's proving the charismatic leader is right. The vision and the prophecy has come true. I'm being attacked. Oftentimes what it is there is an emotional collapse that takes place. There is a feeling of powerlessness that comes over a person, a kind of rock bottom, I think is the way to phrase it, where you eventually realize that the cost of living this life are much higher than the benefits that are accruing to you anymore. And that happens sometimes very early on. For people in their 20s, there may be a moment where they say, why am I giving myself over to this anymore? I'm not getting happiness out of this like I used to. But it can also take years and years. And there may indeed, people may indeed never get to that place. Examples would be members of the Heaven's Gate cult, some of whom are still alive, who feel like they missed the spaceship. And no amount of logic or philosophical inquiry is ever going to get them out of that. It has to be an emotional breakdown where you feel completely lost and detached, and you need that safety net. And that's when you start to revert back to family, friends, and so forth.
Dr. Adam Kunz, thank you so much for joining us on this Easter Sunday. This is a fascinating topic, and let's revisit this. I've got other questions for you we just don't have time for, but your book is called To Hell with Heaven. Where can people reach you if they want to address these issues in more detail?
You can absolutely hit me up on TikTok. I have a TikTok channel called The Apatheist. That's the philosophy that I preach when it comes to religion. I'm also on my website at UW Eau Claire. My email address is kunzas@uwec.edu. You can also find my book on Amazon, or as well as your independent bookseller.